I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
We're back for another episode of Seriously. Lots of things have happened this week.
One of them was me over the weekend accidentally seeing the trailer for the new series and the last series of Downton Abbey and really upsetting myself about it. We're going to, I think, talk about Downton Abbey in more detail in a few podcast time once the new series has actually started. But just the background to this is that I loved Downton Abbey when it first came out, the first couple of series, and then it became dead to me and I ignored it and had no interest in it. And then suddenly I saw the trailer and it had that sad goodbye music playing over it. And I was just, it was the most feelings I've ever had about that TV show.
Yeah, I have really conflicting feelings about Downton Abbey because it's not something that I'd ever be like to a friend like, oh yeah, Downton Abbey's so good. Like,
but I realised seeing the trailer that actually, even though I told myself it was dead to me, I still follow it in the sense that I still know loads about it more than a person really. So I'm kind of, what I'm saying is I'm in denial about it.
Yeah, and I still watch every episode of every season.
I think I missed a few in maybe like 3 or 4.
Sure you didn't miss much.
But no, since then. And yeah, the trailer is fundamentally quite banal, but they've put really sort of sad modern music over it. And it's the last series. I think quite a lot of things that I always wanted to happen are probably going to happen in it.
Yeah, so, finally.
Yeah, it's going to be some wish fulfillment.
The thing about Downton Abbey trailers, rather like Downton Abbey as a programme, is they are so formulaic. They stick to this like very specific recipe. And they used to do, it was every series, I can't remember the name of the choir, that Swedish choir that would cover like pop songs. I think that, I assume that's what's done the music for this latest one. And also the first line of every Downton Abbey trailer is like, time continues to pass, much to my hatred.
Time continues to pass, yet people mysteriously don't get older, apart from the children do.
Yeah, they swap in new kids, but everyone else looks beautiful and exactly the same. But yeah, I do find it really funny that just every single time it's just Hugh Bonneville being like, well, I'm still annoyed about the fact that the clock continues to tick.
Yeah, if I could hold back time, I would, but I can't.
If I could stop history in its tracks, maybe I would. But I can't, Carson. You nor I can hold back time.
I'm sure we'll enjoy it at the time.
I'm not even sure I will. I think this might be the peak of my Downton Abbey enjoyment, because I'm pretty sure that once I watch a whole episode, I will be bored and angry with it again.
Yeah.
But it's just having it condensed down to under a minute of pretty clips of characters I used to really care about with a sort of sad soundtrack was, yeah, it was just Downton Abbey at its purest essence, and it really spoke to me.
Downton Abbey is one of those programmes as well that I watch to talk about because it's so funny. And I spent like 6 months last year writing all the minutiae of every episode, having to write it up when I was interning. And it was actually really good fun because everything in it is so absurd. So I think it'll be prime Seriously stuff.
Yes, yeah. When it comes. Look forward to that, listeners. I think it's this new series starts in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah,
so we might wait for a couple of episodes to be on and then we'll go large on it.
That's got to be the one. There's always one ridiculous episode every series where like something completely overdramatic happens. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's almost all of them, but there's one where it's especially bad. But what we're actually going to get into this week, first of all, is a children's book that we've both read, isn't it?
Yes. So Jacqueline Wilson has done a update, rewrite, whatever you want to call it, of the Susan Coolidge book, What Katie Did. It's called What Katie Did as well? Or
it's called Katie.
It's just called Katie.
Just Katie.
And she's taken the kind of bare bones of the plot and mm-hmm. the main character, and she's updated it for a kind of 21st century context. We both read it quite recently. I also reread the original What Katie Did from the American 19th century children's novel, which I think is from sort of the 1860s.
Yeah, 1867, I had a look.
Yeah, it came out. I had a read about this in the back of the book I've got. It came out very shortly after Little Women, and she had the same publisher as Louisa May Alcott. There was suddenly this market, it seemed like, for kind of gentle stories written by women, and so obviously publishers went mad for it.
They have got quite a similar tone, haven't they,
those
two
books? I suppose, it being a turbulent time politically for America with the Civil War and stuff. They're both from the kind of Yankee perspective, aren't they?
Mm.
They're from in a similar kind of area and sort of style. Yeah, so anyway, the Jacqueline Wilson...
It's moved across the Atlantic as well, hasn't it?
It's moved across the Atlantic. It's become British. It's become 21st century. Mm-hmm. You know, the kids have mobile phones and stuff.
There's an Ocado delivery.
There's
lots of little things like that.
But the fundamentals of the plot are the same, in the sense that it's about a girl called Katie, who I think is about 12 or 13, is the oldest in a large family. She has five or six brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
An important update that Jacqueline Wilson has made, actually, is that rather than her being just the eldest of six kids, they are, I suppose, what you'd call a blended family, in the sense as in the original, Katie and her nearest sister Clover, their mother has died and their father has remarried a woman who already had a younger daughter, and then they've had three more children as well.
Yeah.
So she's got kind of one stepsister and three half siblings, but in essence it's still the same, that she's the eldest of this kind of large tribe of children.
And instead of sort of the spinster aunt figure, you get the stepmum figure. Which is obviously much, much more usual.
Much more realistic, and also I think adds an interesting element, because there is kind of a bit of tension in the original between Aunt Izzy, who is their father's sister who comes to look after them when their mother dies, and in the update, stepmother Izzy, because there's that added kind of, you're not my mum, sort of tension. And also I think she's quite a bit younger, the stepmother as well. So it kind of makes it a bit more three-dimensional.
Yeah, I was surprised by how quite sort of seamlessly it moved into a Jacqueline Wilson world, because the stuff that's in it, that is in the original, if I remember it rightly, because I read it as a child and I can't really remember exactly these issues of like the mother being absent, that's like a very Jacqueline Wilson thing. That even like the opening about her being Katie Carr, which is obviously the character's name in the 1867 book, Katie Carr is such a Jacqueline Wilson name, and like it opens with her in a plastic car and she's like, yeah, I'm Katie Carr in my car. And like Tracy Beaker, I always remember reading Tracy Beaker and reading an interview with Jacqueline Wilson as a kid where she was like, yeah, I just went through my house and I was like, Tracy toilet, Tracy plate, and then I just looked at a beaker and I was like, Tracy Beaker, and that's how I got the name. And I was always, it's just such a Jacqueline Wilson sounding name.
Yeah, it works perfectly. And similarly, so I did reread the original this weekend just gone, and the opening of the book is kind of weird, because it's the author figure, who, or narrator, who we never actually meet or even find out who she is, so I think it's just kind of Susan Coolidge talking, is sort of sitting in a field, and she can overhear the Carr children or something over the hill, and she can hear two of them arguing like, what Katie did, no, Katie didn't, Katie did, Katie didn't, and
that's the
kind of opening of the book, which obviously isn't in the Jacqueline Wilson update, but you do get this sense of her kind of self-actualization of like, I'm Katie, I'm Katie, I'm Katie, before you even really meet her.
Yeah.
Which is, as you say, updates and translates surprisingly
well. Yeah, a very Jacqueline Wilson way of like characters referring to themselves with their full name.
And even other sort of minor plot points, you know, when we first talked about doing it and I saw that she'd done this update, I thought, oh, well, she would have taken the character and the kind of major arc, which is Katie having an accident and then what happens after that, but it won't have been possible for her to translate the kind of minutiae of life in mid-19th century wherever it's supposed to be, like Connecticut or somewhere, into, I don't know whether it's London or another big city, but it's like kind of suburban British 21st century existence. But actually it totally worked. All the stuff about the kids have this kind of secret garden that they like to go and picnic in on a Saturday morning, and their neighbour, who's kind of one of their gang, lives next door, and they like to sit on the garage roof all together. All of this totally works, no matter what century you're in.
There are some things that I think Jacqueline Wilson does very well in terms of like conjuring up that sort of childlike life, and I think things like the Secret Garden is one of them. And there's a really good bit where they meet a new girl from a private school called Imogen, who's based quite heavily, if I remember rightly, on an Imogen in
that's almost exactly the same.
Yeah. Yeah, and she comes into their secret garden and is a bit like, oh, this isn't really what I expected. And I have a really vivid memory of being a kid, and behind our shed at the end of our garden, everything was a bit overgrown, and I would go in there and I called it like a forest or something. And then one time I was like, oh, I'm going to show my cousin my forest, and he was a bit like, this is not a forest. This is just like a bit of space behind your shed. And that feeling of being like, oh God, my imaginary world's just been shattered and there's nothing I can do to reclaim it forever.
I had exactly the same thing. There was a hedge in our garden I used to sit in the middle of, and I thought it was like a kind of woodland paradise and like a special little natural hole in the hedge. And then once my dad found me in there and he was like, why are you sitting in a hedge? And I was like, oh yeah, I am just sitting in a hedge, aren't I?
Yeah, she gets that so well. And one thing that also struck me was, as I was reading Katie, it brought it back to me that I had read what Katie did and all the stuff was coming back to me. And I have a memory of that book as being all about the accident and what happened to Katie. And what happens is she's on a swing and she falls and she has an accident that leaves her in the original bedbound for a long time. But this book isn't a book that's just about an accident and dealing with disability. The whole first half of the book is just about Katie's life and like getting a real sense of her as a character and her friends and all the other expected trials and tribulations of being 11. And then there's also this other element that comes along about halfway through and is what the novel basically deals with until the end.
Yes, so she has done a much better job of making it a novel about some people rather than a novel about an accident.
Mm.
So, because the accident does come quite a bit earlier in the original.
Oh, okay.
And even the stuff that happens before that, you can just tell that it's all there, like seeding various issues that are going to come up later on.
Yeah.
Whereas, you're right, there are things in the first half of Katie where it's just a story about a family. And then this accident happens, and then it's about how the family adjusts and copes afterwards. But also, in the end note of the book, Jacqueline Wilson explains that, so in the original, Katie gets better, so she can't walk for a couple of years, but gradually she gets better.
And whereas, I think that's that final chapter, it's called like At Last or something, isn't it? And it feels a bit like tacked on the end, like, oh, by the way, she could walk.
It does, and also there's a kind of slightly uncomfortable 19th century moralising sense that once Katie had learned to be nicer to her younger siblings, she was therefore allowed to walk again.
Right.
Like she'd become
like God smiled upon her then.
Yeah, she'd become a kind of nicer person. The cousin Helen character in it, who is in the original a cousin, in the update a sort of family friend and former patient of her father's. In the original, she is very much kind of the stereotype of like the happy cripple. And she's there to teach Katie that even if you can't walk, you can still be a pretty dainty asset to the house.
Right. Well, that's quite uncomfortable.
Which is quite
uncomfortable.
Whereas in the update, Katie doesn't get better. Like she is going she's going to be a wheelchair user for the rest of her life. And she sort of says, well, I just think that's much more realistic and much more interesting to see how a character in a family handles that than just going, well, you know, you learned your moral lesson and now you can walk again like magic.
Story that is, but it is a story. It's not real life. And Jacqueline Wilson makes that quite clear by, there's quite a nice bit where her sister, Elsie, writes a sort of card/story where the end of the story is, and then Katie learned to walk again and wasn't it great? And we were all really happy. And Katie says, well, what a lovely idea, but I don't think that's going to happen. And then one of her other friends writes her a graphic novel. I can't remember what it's called now. It's called like Super Wheels or something. Or
Katie Super Wheels.
Katie Super Wheels, yeah. Ultimately a much better story, even though it's unrealistic in its own way, but it's just about somebody like
doing great fantastical things in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
So sort of showing that your fantasy doesn't always have to be
That
you can walk.
Exactly.
You can have exciting, interesting daydreams within the realms of what's happening to you now.
Exactly.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, so that was I think all the changes she's made, that she's really good, I think, at portraying the way other young people can be so clueless and like full of sort of prejudices they wouldn't have as older people. And so there's sort of good bits where kids on the street are like, oh, why is that really big girl in a buggy? And my brother's a wheelchair user, and I remember growing up with him and people saying that kind of thing all the time. And I sort of had forgotten that it's always kids that like say stuff that's like, and obviously they don't mean any harm by it. Sometimes I remember kids would look at him and then turn to their parents and just say, "What's disabled? What does it mean?" You know, and it's so obvious how their thought process has gone. Mm-hmm. But as an adult, you obviously don't do that kind of thing because you know better. But, you know, the ways in which that can sometimes be done on purpose. So there's a sort of rival girl at school who kind of picked on her before and so sees no need to stop picking on her after the accident.
And even sort of uses the fact that Katie's in a wheelchair as a way of kind of scoring points with their teachers and stuff.
Yeah.
Which from an adult perspective, you think like, what a heartless, horrible thing to do. Like, how can you... A terrible thing has happened to this girl. She's not your friend, but, like, she is at least in your class. Terrible thing has happened to her. And you are making her life worse just to score petty points. And you think, actually... I mean, I don't think I actually did that at school, but I'm pretty sure I did some other bad stuff.
Bad things. Yeah.
Because that's... You live in a world where that is your primary motivation, you know, is to make adults think better of you than someone else. And you just don't care what...
Yeah. I also weirdly quite liked her logic, which was like, I didn't like her before.
Yeah.
Just why
do I have to like her now? You know, there is something kind of refreshingly logical about that.
One thing that I find weird about her writing of young people, which I remember because I read loads of Jacqueline Wilson as a 12-year-old, some of the like little phrases and expressions that her characters use, I'm like, I've never heard anyone say that. One of them is, I can't stick that, or I can't stick her, instead of I can't stand her.
Which is quite old-fashioned, isn't
it? Yeah, and like people say a lot of like, oh, I do miss you so. Like, no child says that. I don't know. Maybe I'm just not hanging around with polite enough children. But those kind of things, I'm a bit like... They're just so specific little quirks of Jacqueline Wilson writing, and it was really all coming back to me. So that was like a fun reading experience, if I was a little bit like, do people talk that way?
But something else we talked about the other day, actually, is the fact that because Jacqueline Wilson often tackles the big issues for kids in her books, so, you know, divorce or having a mother who's an alcoholic or illness or death or whatever, and in this case, accidents and disability. Her books are often given to children as presents for whom one of these things has happened.
Yeah.
So like, oh, your parents have split up. Have this book.
The divorce book.
You know, and I'm pretty sure some children who have had accidents and are now in wheelchairs are going to get given this book for Christmas. And that is kind of annoying because just because they're in a wheelchair now doesn't mean they only want to read about stuff that's in a wheelchair. But she does actually take this idea on in the book.
Yeah,
so like,
that's true.
Where I think it's cousin Helen who gives her a DVD of the 2012 Paralympics to watch for Christmas. And she's like, oh, I really don't want to watch like sad disabled people being not very good at sports. So she puts it away for months. And then months later, she watches it. And she's like, oh, this is amazing. Like these people are like so athletic and the best at what they do. And this is so exciting. I'm definitely going to, you know, my PE teacher's been trying to get me interested in wheelchair basketball and I've been putting him off. I'm totally going to take him up on that now because I really want to do this. And so she kind of, within the book, tackles this idea that, yeah, so you might have been given this book for an annoying reason by like a friend of your parents, but actually hopefully there's something in here that you will take away from it that isn't annoying.
Yeah, and she is fairly good at that in you know, obviously it's so simplistic to ever do that to anyone, to be like, oh, well, like, here's the book about, you know, not having a mum. But she is quite, because her books are never just about that, I think, she is quite good at just making them a good read. I mean, you know, I read so many of them. All in all, it wouldn't be so bad if someone did do that with this book.
No, absolutely not. This week we also watched the first episode of the new BBC sitcom Boy Meets Girl, which I enjoyed. How did you find it?
Yeah, I thought it was good. I think that I was holding it up to a sort of comparison with other things, and it didn't quite meet those sort of BBC Two comedy slot standards. But to sort of explain what the programme's about, well, is what it says on the tin. A boy meets a girl, they go on a date. The boy is called Leo and he's just lost his job. I actually think he's a lovely character. He's quite like...
He still lives at
home.
He's
a bit of a goofball.
It's all set in Newcastle, right?
Yeah.
He still lives at home with his family. His brother is like an unemployed waster who apparently seems to get a pass from his parents in the way that he doesn't. And he's what, in his late 20s?
Yeah, yeah, 26, I think they say. Yeah. And then the girl is somewhat older. She's meant to be in her late 30s,
I think.
And her name's Judy. And her backstory is that she's transgender. And the first episode deals with them sort of like going on a date and her saying like straight up, just to let you know, I'm trans.
Look, Leo, there's something that I need to tell you. I could tell you later or I could tell you now, and I'd rather tell you now. I was born with a penis. Hi.
Hi. Are you ready to order?
I think we might need a minute. Maybe a little bit longer.
Then the episode is built around that one day and Judy and Leo's respective sort of conversations with their parents and their family about the fact that they're going on a date, basically, is the setup. And it's very, very sweet. When I say I was comparing it to Stuff, for me, straight away, I'm like, okay, Gavin and Stacey.
That's the same for me.
The first thing you think is like, we'll compare this to Gavin and Stacey, because it's the same thing. The first episode is like about the fact that they're going on their first date. They've been talking on the phone for a while. Mm. And then you get constant like shots of them at home with their respective families. The comedy comes out of a warmth that the characters have for each other, I think. And this is trying to do that as well. For me, it wasn't quite as funny as Gavin and Stacey.
It wasn't quite as funny, but it was as warm, I found.
And yeah, I agree.
I did find the two central characters really lovely and sympathetic, and I really want the best for them, which I think is the intended outcome.
It's quite hard to do that straight off the bat as well.
It is, yeah.
In half an hour.
Absolutely. In half an hour, in something that has to be on like prime time, sort of BBC. I'm trying to think back to when I saw the beginning of Gavin and Stacey. I'm trying to remember how I felt about it at the time, because I think the kind of absurdist comedy that grew out of, because the whole point of Gavin and Stacey.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Was that the two main characters were normal to the point of boring, and the only thing that you liked about them was like their relationship, and then their families were where all the interesting weird people were.
Yeah, though I think the families are weird because they're so normal, if you know what I mean. Like, a lot of the conversations are about like oven gloves and things like that. It's like the classic conversations you would actually have with your family. I remember a quote from James Corden when he was talking about writing it, and he said, well, when I was a kid, my mum used to say, all I do is fill up this bloody fridge and all you kids do is bloody eat everything in there. And he was like, that's hilarious. That's just an inherently ridiculous and funny thing to say, and you couldn't write it. And people say that stuff all the time.
Yeah.
And this kind of works in a similar way, I think. I mean, obviously in Gavin and Stacey, you've got, you know, the two best friends are absurd. That's where, like, Nessa is an absurd character, and they haven't really got that in this one.
Not yet. No, I'm sort of hoping we might meet some more people like that.
Mm.
Like, the bit where Judy comes home for the date and it's gone really, really well, and she's telling her mum and her sister how it's gone, and her mum's so happy for her that she's she's hugging her, but while she's hugging her, her sister's like miming her, yeah, like, do you want some pate? And she like shoves a bit of baguette with some pate like in her mum's mouth while she's like being like, oh love, I'm so glad your date went well.
Yeah. No, that was actually one of the moments that made me laugh out loud, was the pate thing, because it's such a classic, like the being in the kitchen and like mouthing to someone about food while they're having a conversation. It's just something that's so very much part of my growing up. Yeah,
the bit I wasn't quite sure about, so your assumption, and this is our assumption based on, you know, years, decades of prejudiced media
and no trans representation,
is the fact that, so it plays with the idea that Judy is kind of braced to be rejected at all times. You know, she's decided that she's just going to go out there and say what she is and he can take it or leave it, kind of thing.
Just be like, this is who I am, and otherwise it's just a waste of my time.
And she's kind of, what that hints at is the fact that maybe in previous times she's not said it straight up and it's been horrible when the person's found out later on and they've rejected her. So she decided, well, if he's going to reject me, let's get it out of the way before I get too interested or invested in this.
And it's a pretty good, I think, me and my friends often talk about this, is like, if you reveal something about yourself and the other person doesn't like it, it can be quite a good like arsehole barometer.
Yeah.
So it's like you straight away like, oh, you're a transphobe. Bye.
Yeah, exactly. So she hasn't wasted any time on someone like that. But so and of course Leo is not like that, but the script at all times like leaves you hanging and plays with that. So like she says it straight out before they've even ordered and they talk a little bit and then he kind of picks up the menu and goes, so shall we order then? And she goes, oh, do you not want to talk about it? And he's like, oh yeah, I do. I want to hear all about it, but I'm really hungry, so can we order while we're doing it? And that's really endearing and really lovely that that's his response. But the comedy comes from the fact that you, the viewer, assume he's going to reject her.
Yeah. And there's one point he runs out, just disappears, and she's like, oh, have you seen my date? And the waiter's like, he bolted. And then someone forgot their cardigan and he was doing like a nice boy thing of like running out to give them their cardigan, which is sort of, he's very much one of those kind of characters, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He's very obliging and you get the sense
smiley.
He's been fired from his job for being too honest, you know. That's presumably for, you know, because when they asked him, I feel like you don't really want to be here. Do you want to be here? He went, no, I don't really. You know, which is obviously you're not supposed to say. So yeah, I was kind of ambivalent about that. Because on the one sense, you know, I'm really glad that this is a trans character actually being played by a trans actress. That really doesn't happen enough. You know,
she's very, like, very, very good.
A very good actress, really good. Rebecca Root is her name. And I was reading an interview with her in The Guardian, which we'll link to. And I didn't realise, so not only is she an actress, but also she's specially trained in like vocal coaching and like voice studies.
That's cool.
Which I think is really interesting because I thought her voice in it was really, really good.
Yeah, she's got a lovely voice, actually.
And so that, I think that's clearly something she knows a lot about.
And that's something they talk about, isn't it? Because he says, you don't sound like you're from around here. And she is. And she was like, well, part of my like transition was me wanting to get rid of stuff from my past identity. And one of those things was the accent, which says like, goodbye, Johnny Vegas. Hello.
Fiona Bruce.
So it's quite a good...
Yeah, so that's really good use of her talents, I think. I think I'm definitely going to keep watching it, but I'm going to keep watching it in the hope that it moves away a little bit from the kind of making her gender a kind of butt of jokes.
I didn't feel like there were ever any jokes where you were laughing at her.
No, you were never laughing at her, but it was always the premise of the comedy.
Yeah, and it'd be nice to see a bit more. Because, like, for example, there's a joke in it where Judy's mum, she's just, like, a bit in her own world, says things that you've just said, which is obviously something that happens to us all the time. So, like, those kind of jokes, for me, were the funniest bits.
Yeah.
And also, Leo's mum, played by Denise Welsh, is a Pam, like... Gavin's mum in Gavin and Stacey's Pam, also a Pam. Yeah. For me, Denise Welsh is not Alison Steadman.
No, and never will be.
Never will be. But I still think that there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of potential there with the families. I want, like Gavin and Stacey, I want it to be more about the families sort of mixing and maybe less about, like, how do we deal with
gender
issues.
So I'm gonna keep watching it in the hope that that's where it goes rather than kind of... Because I just feel like, you know, she got it out there. Leo was like, I'm fine with that. I really like you. Let's have our first kiss in the rain. It's really nice.
Yeah, that was so romantic, by the way. It was lovely.
It was really lovely. So I really hope... I don't think the characters need to keep rehashing it. Like, they've talked about it. They're fine with it.
Yeah, I think there will, obviously, and I do think this is a good thing to do for them, there will have to be the, like, reveal to the families. Because that's, again, something that they played with.
Yes, yeah.
Is that he was like, oh, there's something you should know about her. And you're a bit like, oh, is he really going to, like, just tell them? Like, and then what he actually says is, oh, I think she's the one. And it's such, it's a really nice moment. It's like very manipulative and good rap, but it's like really, really lovely moment.
A nice thing. And actually, I was so glad to see it starting on, was it on BBC Two?
Yeah, prime time slot.
Rather than, because even Gavin and Stacey started on BBC Three.
It has a BBC Three vibe, I will say.
And then when it did so well, they actually repeated the first series on BBC One. I think they even started repeating it before it had actually finished on BBC Three, so there was like this weird, because there was so much buzz around it. So I'm really glad to see them like having the confidence in it to actually start it, like give it a kind of main channel slot.
Yeah, and we also had an email in from a listener, which kind of crosses over onto this topic. This was Victoria Martin. So Victoria just emailed in to say a book recommendation. So she says, The Art of Being Normal, it's young adult fiction and it's receiving some plaudits at this moment in time. It does feature heavy issues, largely transgender issues. This would be great to hear you both talk about, especially as I'm a transgender woman starting my transition. Well, I think we'll definitely look into that.
We're definitely going to have a read of it. And maybe listeners who've already read it can let us know what they think as well. And generally, you know, this is a great email. Thank you very much, Victoria. And this is exactly the kind of thing we want, because we're very much led by what we like and what we're watching. But we'd love to hear what you'd like us to talk about as well.
And also, this is a point in my life where I'm just finding so many new things to like watch and read and listen to. So yeah, cheers, Victoria. We'll definitely check it out. So last week I recommended that Caroline watch The Falling, which is a film by Carol Morley about girls at a school and then weird stuff happens-ish.
It's really hard to describe.
Yes. The main character is called Lydia, played wonderfully by Maisie Williams, I think. Mm. And it's about her life at school, and she's got a best friend called Abby. So Abby gets pregnant and then starts having weird symptoms. These aren't normal pregnancy symptoms,
right?
Well,
she has
right?
a few normal pregnancy symptoms, like she's sick and everything starts tasting weird to her. But she also like faints a lot, and eventually like she faints and sort of has a kind of fit and she dies.
And it's like a big trauma for obviously for all her friends and all the girls at the school. Mm. And then the film is basically about the fallout from that, which is they all start fainting too. So it's like a literal fall. They're all like literally just dropping to the ground in a very, it's not like a normal faint, is it? It's very sort of stylized. There's hands lifting up in the air and there's weird expressions, and it's it seems almost like a combative fainting,
or a bit like they're kind of possessed by something else.
Exactly.
And then they pass out. Yeah.
Now have absolute silence. Sit, stand. Silence in the corridors and communal areas. Skirts no more than 2 inches from the ground when kneeling. You are not to fraternize with any of these girls.
Who was the first person in your age group to show symptoms?
You all know something is wrong.
So I'm sure anyone listening can hear that this is a very unusual film. What did you think, Caroline?
I really don't know what I think. I was very kind of ambivalent about it while I was watching. And I was even bored a little bit, to the point where like I paused it in the middle and went to make lunch kind of thing. So I wasn't completely absorbed in it. But I mean, I watched it like a day and a half ago, and it's all I've been thinking about. And now I feel like, actually, maybe it's brilliant.
Yes.
And I can't fully decide. And there are so many overlapping and conflicting things about it. So I read a couple of interviews with Carol Morley after I watched it, and she said that she really wanted to try and dramatise this thing of mass hysteria, which sometimes happens in places, and it often seems to happen with young girls, where a traumatic inciting incident occurs, and then a whole lot of other people exhibit the same symptoms. So there's a long article by her in The Guardian talking about this, which we'll link to, where she said there was a case somewhere in South America where a girl started like twitching and then everyone else started twitching, and you know, they all got checked out for epilepsy and stuff, and none of them had anything that was showed up on tests, but they were all just twitching. And it's a recognised psychological thing And it does seem, for reasons they don't really seem to know, 90% of these cases occur in sort of teenage girls.
Mm.
And so this is what she wanted to dramatise. And she does that very successfully. But what she also does is get across this feeling that, yes, it's probably all in their minds.
Mm.
But that doesn't make it not real.
Yeah. There is sort of a strong implication that perhaps Lydia, out of just being frustrated by the school, and there's a lot of sort of about the systems of the school that they have to belong to, and like nobody understanding her best friend's death, is acting out and like as a form of rebellion, making these girls resist against what the school wants them to do, which is to stop fainting and to behave and to hold back this inner sort of, I guess, sexuality. I think it's heavily implied that could just burst out of them any time. I think in the same way, for example, that the Virgin Suicides, I would say, is not really a great portrait of depression or suicide.
Yeah.
It's taking that idea and building an atmosphere around it and looking at it through a very sort of aesthetic and weird eye. Yeah,
that's it. It's an atmosphere rather than a story, almost.
Yeah.
And the way a lot of the time scenes are intercut in a kind of juddery way with beautiful but sort of decaying landscape around this school, like this big pond and this massive tree and all these falling leaves and stuff. And every so often a vision of something horrible flickers onto the screen.
Yeah, just flashes in front of your eyes.
And then disappears.
Very unsettling in that way. I think it's a very like textured film. There's like a lot of close-ups of like soft skin and hair and leaves and wet and damp, you know, mud, and then like there's a whole note of picking. She like picks at the wall repeatedly, and there's like stuff in the wall.
That was the part. So she sort of does that. There's her little clique of friends hang out in the bathroom, which is something all girls do at school. And to start with, Abby at the beginning is doing it. It's like picking at the kind of peeling plaster on the wall. And then after she dies, Lydia carries on doing it almost in a kind of slightly mutated way of like, well, I want to continue her work.
Yeah, this is all sort of in the background as well. It's not like consciously talked about. It's happening on screen sometimes.
And then at the end, Lydia kind of has a bit of a meltdown and she like is pulling chunks out of the wall. And for, I don't know why, but for a second I thought, oh God, she's going to find something horrible in the wall, isn't she? You know, there's going to be like a dead body in there or something, and this is going to explain why all of this has happened. But actually, of course, it isn't.
Yeah.
It's just
something she's doing in the background.
There is a bit of a revelation that, because she has a really difficult relationship with her mum, who is played amazingly by Maxine Peake.
Yeah, she's
who
fantastic.
Who is agoraphobic and hasn't left their house in years, that she's a hairdresser and all her clients come to the house, so she never has to leave. And yeah, they fight all the time, and her brother's really weird and sort of weird and horrible and stuff.
Yeah, there's a sort of heavy incest.
There's a heavy kind of incest
narrative.
And her brother's really into what he calls magic with a K. And he keeps whispering about ley lines and other sort of psychic phenomena that...
He's struggling, clearly,
you know. So they're both kind of trying to process the fact that their mum is really absent and troubled herself in different ways. So then when there is a kind of big revelation about why her mother is like that, I almost found that less interesting than all of the atmospheric stuff that had gone before. I thought Mark Kermode wrote a really, really good piece about the film that I read after I watched it, where he sort of said this as well, that once you find stuff out, you sort of care less than when you didn't know, and it sort of tarnishes it slightly once you...
Yeah, I think one of the great things about the film is that so much is left unexplained at the end. There were so many things I liked about it. I think, so this is a film that really would fall under all my specific interests of like teenage girls, mass hysteria, nice, you know, that sort of like virgin suicide aesthetic.
1969.
Yeah.
And so they all wear sort of strict school uniforms, and all the teachers have, you know, hair that still looks like it's from the war, some of them, and, you know.
Yeah, so that's like tailor-made for me as a film, and, you know, great woman director, everything, but I still left the cinema feeling extremely frustrated, and like it was almost too much, all those things, and not enough of a film. And actually, as a week passed, I thought about nothing else, and by the end of the week was like, wow, I honestly think there is so much going on in this film constantly. Like what you're talking about with the wall, right down to these little things going on in the background. She's always sort of like metaphorically explaining what's happening in the plot. You know, they're all like demolishing the school, I think, in some ways. and rebelling against this idea that I think a lot of us have as teenagers, which is when your parents and your teachers and people like that are sort of telling you that you're losing innocence in a weird way. So there's a lot about like measuring the length of skirts and things like that going on in the film. And Abby's obviously found this incredible sexual power that people are very suspicious of. But at the same time, all the girls seem to know that they actually are losing innocence in a way that they don't want to, but it's much more internal and it's got nothing to do with the length of their skirts, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And she's really good at getting at that turmoil that's going on in a lot of them.
A bit where one of the girls is being interviewed by the doctor later on and he asks her, have you ever had sexual intercourse? And she goes, yes, no, I don't really remember. Mm. Which is exactly that, in the sense that you feel like she feels like she has to say yes, then she probably says the truth, which is no, but then some other stuff has happened and she's not sure whether it counts, so she says, I don't know. But also she's like, well, what is the right answer? Is the right answer yes, I have, or no, I haven't? I don't know what you want, you know? And that is, I felt, summed that up for me. Another bit I really liked was there are a few scenes where it's just the teachers talking, and there's this one bit where the head teacher is talking to, I think, their kind of form teacher, and they're talking about the, you know, the falling, the sort of fainting epidemic that swept the school. And she says something like, they, you know, they think it's so hard to be a teenage girl. They should try being a middle-aged woman.
Yeah.
And then they both laugh hysterically.
It's a lovely moment, actually.
But it's so true. You know, you feel like these are women who probably either had men they loved die in the war or somehow their lives were changed. The fact that they ended up as like spinster teachers in a girls' school was not by choice.
Mm.
And they feel frustrated and thwarted in their lives as well, but all the more of that because they're now old and therefore invisible. And just that little touch of that...
Yeah.
And all the other stuff just, yeah, was brilliant.
But I do think, I mean, shout out to Maisie Williams for just like being amazing. Like, what an excellent actress she is. The soundtrack, Tracy Thorn, amazing.
Fabulous music.
Really,
yeah.
Really weird, really engrossing. I'm obsessed with Wordsworth. I loved all the Wordsworth bits, and obviously this film is about innocence and the loss of it and so on. I just thought there was a lot of depth to it, and I'm really excited to go back and watch it for a second time and like really readjust my sort of thoughts about it, because I just think she's like achieved something really cool, which is to make you a little bit uncomfortable in the cinema, even though she's created a very beautiful film. It is a very unsettling film. And to make me think about something for a full week, I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's what I'm finding still so interesting about my reaction to it, is that when, you know, we've just deconstructed it like that, listing out all the things, these are all things I like and I'm really interested in.
Mm.
So why was I so sort of uncomfortable while I was watching it? I can't get to the bottom of that, but I really want to.
Yeah.
And that is kind of endlessly interesting. So yeah, it's on balance, I would absolutely recommend the film to people.
As a watching experience.
As a watching experience, but not necessarily as a kind of universally positive experience.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, actually, I think out of all the things we've recommended on this show, I would be like, go and watch this.
Mm.
I saw it in the cinema, but like, it's not really been at many cinemas, and it certainly wasn't for very long.
I think I was only aware of it coming out when it did because I follow Tracy Thorn on Twitter,
right.
And she was tweeting about it because she'd done the music.
Of course.
That was my only... I didn't feel like it really like entered my bubble otherwise.
Yeah, but I just think whether you might not like it, it's true, but I just think it is doing a lot of interesting work, so definitely go out and watch it.
So for next week, we're going to take a complete departure from fascinating films about innocence, and I'm going to recommend Anna a few episodes of the BBC Radio 4 comedy Cabin Pressure, which I am a massive fan of. I've actually written a piece in the magazine that's out at the moment, which is like my whole theory of radio comedy, which, you know, people can read if they like it. But Cabin Pressure has been a real hit for the BBC in the last few years in a way that very little comedy on the radio ever is. Part of this is down to the fact that it has Benedict Cumberbatch in. But
oh no.
But I'm recommending it to you in spite of this. He is absolutely not the reason why you should listen to it.
Okay.
The reason you should listen to it is because it's really, really brilliantly written and really funny.
Okay.
It also has Roger Allam and Stephanie Cole
cool.
in it. And it's a little sitcom set on a charter airline. So it's about people running an
airline.
Cabin Pressure. And it's about the places they go and the stuff they have to take there and the people they meet. It's a very simple and traditional sitcom in that sense. And then all of the comedy and sort of tension comes from the incredibly like witty dialogue and sort of slightly absurdist situations that then gets twisted into.
Awesome.
So Anna's going to give that a go, and hopefully some of you will as well. And we'll see what she thinks next week.
Yay. See you then. for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. I'm Anna.
And I'm Caroline. You can find us on iTunes.
Our Twitter is at SeriouslyPod.
And if you want to send us an email, we're SeriouslyPod, SRSLY, pod@gmail.com.